Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Cody Keenan, former speechwriter to Barack Obama, welcome to the show and welcome back to Ireland.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Cody, before we get to speeches and Obama and your book, this is your 10th visit to Ireland. So Keenan, obviously, I'm thinking you're second generation Irish.
Seventh.
I didn't think the records went back that far. So, yeah. So great.
1750s, believe it or not.
Right.
So it's I've been kind of feeding off it.
Okay, you must have like about 32 other nationalities in there if you go back that far as well.
Yeah, like Irish, Scottish, the whole shebang. Yeah,
but you've run with the Irish one. Were you brought up in an Irishy kind of household? Was there Irish dancing and that kind of thing?
No, I'm the first one who's ever come back.
Really,
my parents have never been. My grandparents never came. Obviously, nobody before that. I was raised in Chicago, you know, which has a proud Irish population. So we had step dancers at St. Francis Church down the street. But it wasn't until I started working for Senator Ted Kennedy in the early aughts that I actually started thinking about and exploring heritage and ancestry. And, you know, the thing about being American is it's the story we tell ourselves. If I had, you know, the Scotch lineage comes from the name Mackenzie in our family. And if my last name was Mackenzie, I might think something different of myself, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, we all need a story and some roots, don't we? And what have you been up to on this visit?
I've done 11 book events on tour. Trinity, Dublin City University, the Oireachtas, the Embassy, up in Belfast, DFA, everywhere.
Okay, you're well connected, aren't you?
Yeah, it's just been a blast, though. I love coming here. You know, I've joked, there are a lot of Irish European capitals I haven't been to yet. And yet I just keep coming here.
Yeah. So after Ted Kennedy, you did 14 years with Obama. And like, in a way, you'd done your bit for democracy then, and you were kind of due a big cash in. Like your predecessor, Jon Favreau, was practically a one-man multimedia empire at this stage. You went off and became a teacher. You kind of stayed with public service, yeah?
Couple reasons for that. One is to assuage my guilt for no longer being in public service.
Okay.
But two is, I had my time in the sphere, and it is time for fresh blood, I think, everywhere. And so I feel like the best thing I can do now is to train a new generation to go out, and eventually I'll have my own little army of speechwriters all across American politics.
Yeah. And I suppose this is your commitment to what you say, calling the title of your book, the Battle for America, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is.
So you did write a book. You're having that little cash in. It's called Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America. And listen, having read it, I feel I've lived those 10 days as well. Like you do really bring us there. And it was an intense 10 days. Explain to people why it was so important in that battle for the meaning of America.
Yeah. When I left the White House, I stayed with President Obama for 4 years to help him with his memoirs. And then when I decided to write a book, I figured I'm not going to write a memoir myself. What I focused on was those 10 days in June of 2015. They begin with the massacre in Charleston, South Carolina, where a white supremacist went into a black church and murdered 9 parishioners during Bible study and said he wanted to start a race war. And over the course of the week, the drama in the book is, you know, we were deciding whether or not to give a eulogy at all, because we had, together, Obama and I had written more than a dozen after mass shootings. Meanwhile, we're also preparing for Supreme Court cases on marriage equality and Obamacare. So all these questions are coming up about what it actually means to be an American, whether or not we care about, you know, standing up for equality against white supremacy, you know, making sure that people who work 2 jobs have health insurance, making sure that gay people can get married like the rest of us. And all this kind of came together in 10 days. And over the course of those 10 days, we almost became the best version of ourselves. By the end, once we won those Supreme Court cases, which was an open question, Obama gave the Amazing Grace eulogy. It almost felt like we were breaking free of our past into the future. It almost felt like the future had arrived a little early. And there's something exhilarating and frightening about that. And then obviously we lived through the backlash over the next 4 years. And all of it just goes to show that democracy is a constant battle.
Yeah.
And you cannot give up. And you have to protect all the progress you've earned and build on it and keep it. It's precious.
So as you said, he did give the eulogy in the end, and people will remember it for a particular reason as well. We have a clip here of him at Charleston.
Amazing grace. Amazing grace. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that
An extraordinary moment. People will find the video of it if they go Google it or whatever, but it's that sense of the all the preachers behind him joining straight away, the band coming in gradually. He had kind of said he might sing, had he?
He did. A lot of this book too is about the wonderful and terrible struggle of being a speechwriter.
Yeah.
And I agonized over this eulogy over the course of the week because, you know, when we were having a pretty heated debate in the Oval Office about whether or not to do it.
So the idea of him not wanting to do it or not being sure if he should, is it just, I'm not doing this again kind of thing. I've done this too many times.
Yeah, it actually goes back to 2013 when we, after the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, when 20 little children were murdered in their classrooms, he set aside his second term agenda and tried to do something about guns. And ultimately, universal background checks were blocked in the Senate by Republicans, you know, with the families of those kids looking on. And that's about as cynical as I've ever seen the president. He came in, he gave a statement in the Rose Garden after that vote and came in and said, look, the next time this happens, I don't want to speak. If we've decided we're just not going to do anything about this, then I don't want to contribute to this cycle where, you know, we all fight for a while and then I give a eulogy and we all move on.
Mm.
This was obviously different. And when we were having that argument about whether or not to do it, when he finally agreed, he looked at me and said, look, I've run out of words. You know, do you have anything to say? And I said, no. And he said, all right, if we're going to do this, go write about guns, write about race, write about the Confederate flag, and wrap it all up in the concept of grace. And I just kind of looked at him and said, oh, is that all? So it was terrifying. You know, writing about race is always kind of fraught, especially you're very mindful that you're a white person doing it for the first black
president.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and so I handed him a draft after agonizing over it for 3 days, and he called me back to the White House the night before the eulogy at midnight. And in just 3 hours, he had crossed out the last two pages completely, which he had never done to me before, and rewrote them longhand. And it was beautiful. He took the lyrics to Amazing Grace and built a structure around it. And it was so simple, I could have kicked myself for missing it. Mm. And then the following morning, the 10th day of the book, he went out and spoke on marriage equality, and it was just jubilation everywhere. And we get on the helicopter and to head to Charleston, and he says, you know, if it feels right, I might sing it. And that hadn't occurred to me either. And that only comes from, he has really deep experience in the black church that I just don't have. You know, he knew that if he started singing, everybody would join in. He knew what that gesture would mean, that leap of faith. And I forgot to tell anybody else at the White House. I told my wife, but I didn't give a heads up to the communications staff. So everybody was surprised.
Mm. And I believe he said, was it E flat, which is the bluesiest chord, is that right?
Yeah, it's E flat. It's the blackest blues note, is what Questlove of the Roots said.
Okay.
So yeah, I asked him what the, you know, before that clip, he paused for about 11 seconds. And I knew he was going to sing, but I was worried that people at home would think he'd lost a page.
Mm.
And so I asked him on Air Force One after the speech, you know, what was with the pause? Was that to build dramatic effect? And he goes, no, you know, the thing about singing Amazing Grace is you got to start low. Otherwise, by the time you get to a wretch like me, your voice will start cracking.
You got to hit
E flat.
Yeah. So listen, I think one thing that comes across very clearly in the book is that, politics aside, you liked working for him because you thought he was cool, didn't you?
Yeah. He was cool. He was a great boss. The demands of working for him are different as a writer, because he is a writer and he had such high expectations for.
And a better writer knew he would.
He would remind us of that all the time. Yeah. That was the terrible part of the struggle. I loved working for him and hated it at times, just because it was so challenging and stressful. But we also had a very unique White House, and that more of us stayed for 8 years than any other administration. You know, we were just kind of forged into a family on the campaign, and so many of us married each other and lived together, and just, we were and still are a family in a lot of ways. And he was generous enough to have me and my wife and our family over to the White House on our wedding day. And that's just, it's not something a lot of bosses do, you know?
Yeah. Tell me about the time he sent you home to find the silence in the speech.
This was early 2015, State of the Union address, which is a beast. It's just a laundry list, an hour-long policy narrative, basically. And that it falls to the speechwriter to figure out how to put, you know, 40 or 50 disparate policy ideas into one story. So I worked really hard through, you know, the third straight Christmas I'd ruined doing just that. And I gave it to him 8 days before. And he said, hey, it's a new record. Here's the thing. Everything is in here. And I said, well, yeah, that's what a State of the Union address is. Mm-hmm. Everything is in here. He goes, no, let me put it this way. Everything's at a 10. Every word means something. Every sentence says something. I need quiet moments and emotion and humor and you know, breaths. And he asked if I listened to jazz. And I said, no, not really. He said, well, you know what they say about Miles Davis? And I said, no, not really. And he said, it's the silences. It's the space between the notes. It's the notes you don't play. That's what made him so good. So I want you to go home tonight. Don't do any work. I want you to listen to Miles Davis, pour yourself a drink, and come back here tomorrow and find me some silences.
Mm. And did you get it in Miles?
I did. I think that was probably our best State of the Union address, which is still pretty low bar.
What do you think of Joe Biden?
I have great personal affinity for Joe Biden. You know, I got to work with him for 8 years in the Obama White House, and I have several handwritten notes from Joe Biden that are just these wonderful gestures. Anytime you do anything for him, he's a good Irishman.
Yeah. So he's a man who comes from the heart.
Just that you cannot fake. And his, you know, his true strengths. People often ask me about the differences between their speaking styles, and everybody has a different speaking style. But Biden has this incredible empathy to him that only comes from enduring tragedy. You know, when he is with somebody else who has suffered, he's just, it's an amazing thing to see.
So he's coming here in just a few weeks now. You've been part of these big presidential visits to Ireland. So what's happening now to get ready for that?
Well, first of all, I'm very jealous because I don't know anything about the trip, but it's the worst kept secret in Ireland. I've been hearing from everyone all week that he's coming for 6 days. We were here for, I think, 12 hours in 2011. Yeah. You know, we had to leave early for the volcano, the ash cloud. What's happening is, I'm sure the DFA is working closely with the State Department, and they're trying to figure out which parts of the city to shut down and how all the security is going to work. It's a big operation. Again, I know nothing, but I'd be surprised if he didn't go to the places where he's got some heritage.
Yeah. Is he going to go for re-election, do you think? Should he?
I think yes on both counts. I think he's going to. I don't know for certain. And I think he should. I think he's done a really good job under incredibly tough circumstances. You know, there are a lot of my former colleagues who work for him now. And those first 2 years in COVID were really rough, you know, just like they were for any public servant here. I mean, the White House was empty, and they're just, everybody's working from home, and it's very difficult to run the country that way. Mm. But they corralled COVID as best they could in the states. And he's passed some extraordinary legislation and more bipartisan legislation than we did. I'll give him credit on that. You know, one of the biggest climate bills in American history. It'll never be big enough, but he's passed some really, really important stuff. He's done a good job. That said, and while he has my wholehearted support, one of the things I'd love to see in our democracy is the younger generation take over.
I mean,
we are a true gerontocracy at this point, and I think things are only going to get better once people who are more representative of the country are in charge. I mean, his heart's in the right place.
But you think he's possibly the best stabilizing force right now after the last while, yeah?
Yes, and memories are short, and that's exactly what we needed after the Trump years, was a stabilizing force. You know, someone who's boring is okay.
excuse me. Cody, not to demean what you do and everything, but we're heading into wedding season in Ireland. And a lot of guys who've never spoken publicly before are going to have to make a wedding speech, and girls. So any tips?
Keep it short.
Yeah.
Keep it short. I say this, this is no exaggeration. I sat through a half hour long wedding toast once, half hour, and people just started getting up and going to the bar. And you don't want to see that in the middle of your toast. 2 minutes. If you're the best man or the maid of honor, you get 4. It's not about you. Don't tell stories that no one else will know. No inside jokes that nobody else understands.
Yeah.
Just find something about the bride or the groom that lends itself to a larger truth about human existence, and make people laugh, and then offer up a strong clink at the end.
I love it. Perfect. Cody Keenan's book, Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America, is out now. Cody, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great to be here.